got three R's we're gonna talk about today. We gotta learn to reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Well, if you're going to the market to buy some juice, you gotta bring your own bags and you learn to reduce your waste. We gotta learn to reduce. And if your brother or your sister's got some cool clothes, you could try them on before you buy some more of those. Reuse. We gotta learn to reuse.
Exactly. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310. Deb, what do I say every day when I come in here? Reduce, reuse, recycle.
Yes.
It's a mantra.
It certainly is.
And that's the theme song for our guest today. Please join me in welcoming Kevin Roche. He's the general manager of Eco Maine. It's great to have you here today, Kevin.
Great to be here today. Thank you.
Reduce, reuse, recycle. Have you ever been introduced with that song before?
I have not. That's great, though. I'd like to hear it again.
You need to incorporate it as your personal theme song. I want to hear it on your voicemail, in your car, everywhere.
It's a possibility.
I think it applies. Before we talk about all the great work that's being done at Eco Maine, if you wouldn't mind just taking a minute, as the general manager, I'm always interested in terms of how people come to Maine and come to various positions that really impact our state. So talk a little bit about how you ended up here, where you went to school, and then we'll talk about your work at Eco Maine and what that means for all the municipalities that are part of Eco Maine.
Sure, sure. Well, landed in this industry, I went to the University of Buffalo and studied geography. And at that time, Geographic Information Systems, now Google Maps, was something that I was interested in. And my first project was putting garbage routes for the city of Rochester, New York, on ArcInfo, which now would be something like Google Maps. So, you know, where the garbage routes would drive down the one-way streets, right, and so forth and so on.
To make it more efficient, or what was the mapping? What was the purpose?
They had, at the time, seven-person crews. One driver on the driver of the garbage truck, two employees that brought the cans from the garage to the curb, two employees that emptied those cans into the garbage truck, and two employees that returned those cans back to the garage.
Wow.
That was the level of service back then. And so they were going to a semi-automated system, reducing their crews and rerouting the entire city. And so they wanted to use, you know, we were using the old maps, and at that time we were just beginning to introduce computerized mapping. And so that's how I landed into the garbage business.
The waste business is, you know, what did Tony Soprano used to call it? You know, he was in like waste management engineering or something.
Sounds good.
It sounds good.
Very official.
So how did you end up coming here to Maine? What first brought you here? And when did that happen?
Well, in 2004, Eco Maine, then RWS, or Regional Waste Systems, was recruiting for a general manager. And they did a national recruitment. At the time, I was living in Binghamton, New York, working in a similar capacity as the solid waste director in that city. And so I responded and came in for a couple of interviews. The whole process took, I think, about 6 months.
Wow.
And I was fortunate enough to land the position. And I've been here for almost 10 years. It'll be 10 years October.
That's incredible. And I want to talk about all the details, but I need to take you back to a young Steve-O. How long? Okay, let's go half a century.
Where's that young Steve-O music?
Oh, do we have young Steve-O? There should be young Steve-O music. This is during the Eisenhower administration. When I grew up in a small town outside of Boston called Needham, it's not that small. I guess it had about 30,000 people. What I remember about waste management is we had a garbage pail outside of the house, which was, you know, you stood on a foot thing and the thing popped up. And all this is before garbage disposals, you know, before the art of the mechanical garbage disposal that almost every home has now in their kitchen sink.
The pig.
Yeah, I mean, which is it chops it up, and then the sink and the water puts it through the system. But before that, 40 years ago, 45, 50 years ago, we used to, you know, have dinner, and then we would put all of the garbage. You know, my mom would yell, "Steve!" Well, she yelled at me a lot, but in this particular instance, take the garbage out to this pail. And because Needham, Mass, much like Maine, is a cold weather place most of the time and there's water, the pail would always rust out. And we would fill the pail full of garbage, every kind of garbage you put in your garbage disposal. And without getting too graphic on WLOB 1310 radio, the garbage pail was a petri dish for like maggots, for all kinds of stuff. And that's how you handled garbage waste. And then once a week, we would load trash into the back of the station wagon. I'd get in the back and the trash would be in my lap. My brother would be hitting me. And again, that's more of a family dynamic that we want to get into. And we would go to what we called the dump. And we'd go down this long dirt road in off of Central Ave, Adita, Mass. And we would get to the end, and there'd be like a dirt drop-off. And then there would be 1,000 seagulls, right? And then you would just whip the bags off into this giant mountain of trash and glass. And then there'd be a giant earth-moving equipment smushing it and doing it. We've come a long way, haven't we? That's a long way of going, but those are my memories. So why don't we go from that as being the state-of-the-art 50 years ago. And by the way, we have Kevin Roche. He's the general manager of EcoMaine. And talk a little bit about how, where we've come, why, and then talk a little bit about EcoMaine.
Sure. You know, Steve-O, you're laughing when you say that, but we may be going back there.
We're going back there. Back to Needham, Mass.
What? Please explain.
Well, you know, back when you used to separate your, we call it now, organic waste. We don't call it garbage, okay?
Of course.
But right now, organic waste is still part of what we call the trash because, you know, you described we used to separate what we would refer to today as organic waste, you know, your kitchen scraps, your food waste, things like that, from the trash. And now and then over the years we combined those together and you know everything got combined together and now what you're seeing is communities are going back to separating food waste from their regular trash. So hopefully they won't have to use that maggot jar or that pail that was full of maggots. It'll be a cleaner process. But you're seeing big cities and small cities alike. In fact, a town not far from there, I believe, Hamilton, Massachusetts,
sure,
has gone to a pail collected separately from the trash at the curb on a weekly basis, and that's just dedicated for food waste.
Wow. And what are they doing with it?
They take it to a composting facility right located in the town of Hamilton called Brickyard Farm, and they compost the material, they mix it with leaves, and make a soil amendment out of it.
Wow. What again, I don't want to get, because these bring back childhood memories, and I probably don't want to go there, but when people take organic waste and when it goes through the sewer system and it goes through waste transfer and it becomes liquefied, what is the environmental impact and why is that either good or bad, and how do we get to the place 30-40 years ago where all of a sudden somebody thought, boy, a garbage disposal, chopping this up, putting it into, and then it has to be treated, has to be mechanically treated, then chemically treated. Talk about that for a second, and you just mentioned that we may be going back to using organic waste for purposes other than just flushing it down the sink.
Well, I'm a solid waste guy. I'm not a wastewater guy.
Okay.
But I know a little bit about the industry. But I think if you ask the wastewater experts, they would tell you that they don't love all that food waste going down the drain because it overloads their system with that type of material. And so they would just as soon have the solid waste folks, like myself, handle that material rather than it going down the drain. And a lot of Maine is on septic, too.
Right.
So you certainly don't want to put down, you know, food waste going down the drain into a septic system because you'll overload your septic system and you could see a failure there. The other thing is, you know, you're not going to put your turkey carcass down the drain either. So you're not going to put, you know, your meat down the drain.
Now, wait a second. This is news for me. I am not supposed to put the turkey thing into the garbage disposal. So all those years, I was chopping it up and putting it in. You're saying that's not advisable.
I think you're unique.
Okay, I'm kidding. Of course you don't put the turkey carcass, right, Deb? You don't do that. That's not okay. So, Well, that's interesting. Let's shift back to EcoMaine and solid waste. We have Kevin Rochier as the general manager. Let's talk a little bit, and we'll start with what EcoMaine is. What are the member municipalities and how it was formed in terms of its history? And then later on, we'll talk about what you do for these different municipalities and kind of the state of that. So we'll just give people that. I think everyone's heard of EcoMaine, but why don't you just kind of describe it organizationally?
I'll start by just our mission statement is pretty short.
Great.
EcoMaine provides comprehensive, long-term solid waste solutions in a safe, environmentally responsible, economically sound manner, and is a leader in raising public awareness of sustainable solid waste management strategies. That actually explains who we are pretty well.
Great.
We own and operate three facilities. We have a waste-to-energy plant that makes electricity from the burning of the waste. We have a single-sort recycling facility. We also have a landfill for that material that can't be processed at the recycling facility, or the ash that is generated from the waste-to-energy plant actually ends up in the landfill. And those facilities are, like I said, owned and operated by EcoMaine. We are governed by a 29-member board of directors. So, for example, Portland, the city of Portland would have five seats on our board. Falmouth has a seat on our board. Yarmouth has a seat on our board. Anyway, you know, we have 21 owner communities, and in addition to that, we have another 26 member communities. So that's a, 27 member communities. And the only difference between the owner communities and the contract communities is that the owner communities actually own the organization, and the contract communities we have just contracts with, they don't actually have ownership.
So you're not a government, enterprise. So there's no government funding. Is this self-sustaining based on the owner and the member organizations, or is there any government interface or policy interface with the state of Maine?
Yes, we are a quasi-municipal, non-for-profit organization, and we are owned by those 21 owner communities. So they own us. They're on the hook for EcoMaine. However, we have various revenue sources. For example, we charge a tipping fee for the trash coming in. We sell the recyclable materials from our recycling facility, and that's worth $3-4 million a year.
Wow.
We sell the electricity as well, which is worth another $3-4 million a year. So we have several revenue sources that cover our expenses. And then in some cases, there's an assessment back to the communities. However, the communities are eliminating the assessment and starting in, July of 2014, which I think is good news for, our, listeners.
I think you also recently announced that there is some revenue returning to communities, right? That was kind of a big announcement, and it's significant, especially in today's budget climate and economic climate.
Yeah, we've our communities have invested in some state-of-the-art technology to manage waste, and those we paid off our debt last year, so we are now a debt-free organization. And since that time, our balance sheet is strong, and we're able to return some funds back to the communities by reducing assessments and reducing the tipping fee.
Great. We have Kevin Roche. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. You read the mission statement relative to EcoMaine, but when people think about EcoMaine, I think recycling comes to mind. I think handling the waste. Looking at the history of recycling, has that whole genre of business or that genre of the processing of materials, has it changed? And if so, in what way? Has it changed, whether it's the makeup of aluminum cans or plastic or PET, or it used to be water bottles were much thicker. Now I think there's a lot of pressure on water companies and soda companies to be more. And then same thing when you go shopping. There's paper, there's plastic. So it looks like the landscape of consumerism is changing. But how has that changed the actual processing at EcoMaine?
Sure. I think the most two notable things that I would mention is number one. And back in 1989, we were trying to sell recycled milk jugs. So when you buy milk, you buy it in a gallon jug. It's that natural colored plastic, HDPE. And back in 89, I used to have to pay a company to come to, you know, we would bale all that material up, and we'd get a 23-ton load of milk jugs. That's a lot of milk jugs. But we had to pay a company to take that material away from us. Today, and we had to pay for the transportation, too. Today, we're selling that same material. We don't have to pay for transportation. Much of that material goes to York, Pennsylvania, so it's a distance away. And they make new plastic bottles out of the old plastic bottles, and they're paying us $850 a ton. So that is remarkable. The demand change for that particular commodity has changed significantly. So between 89 and 2014, that's where the price has gone from negative to a positive $850 a ton. And we're seeing that with several of the plastic streams, not all. The other thing that's, I think, real significant and would be interesting for our listeners is we sell a lot of newspapers. We call it ONP, old newspapers. I've been selling old newspapers for 25 years. 25 years ago, when we sold bales of newspapers, it looked like newspapers. Today, when you come to our plant and you see our bales of what we still call newspapers going out the door, it no longer looks like newspapers because there are so few newspapers out there.
Right.
And so it looks like junk mail. It looks like there's still a lot of magazines. There's still a lot of catalogs, but it's full of color. And back 25 years ago, it was black and white newspapers, and that's it.
Well, and when you talk about, you know, different materials and color, is that harder to recycle or process? Because are you dealing with inks? Or are you dealing with other elements? Is it better to have newspaper, or all those inserts, are they tougher to recycle?
Well, 25 years ago, we had to separate the inserts. So if you put your Sunday inserts in with the newspaper, we had to pull them out at the recycling plant.
Wow.
If you put magazines in there with the glossy coated magazine clay content, we had to sort those out. Over the years, the de-inking industry, the mills, actually got to like that clay content in the mix because it helped with the de-inking process. And so then they asked for it, and it accelerated the recyclability of the material, made it much easier to get it to market.
Let me check to see if Deb is still awake here. Deb, do you recycle?
I do recycle.
And how so? And how has, in the last decade or so, how has recycling in your day-to-day life? Do you shop differently? Do you look for materials that you think are better for the environment? Are you still using old light bulbs or you know, what is CFLs? And how, again, putting you on the spot, people listening on radio can't see it, but Deb is waving fanatically at me. Like, why are you putting me on the spot? Why are you doing that to me? But that's okay. That's what happens here.
Shy.
That's what happens here at Tide Smart Talk. Put you on the spot. So how is your life in terms of consumerism and day-to-day life at the Debbie Davis house changed relative to recycling and the environment?
I got to tell you, I honestly don't pay a lot of attention to it, at least up until about a year ago, for packaging when I'm in the store shopping. But my grandson brought packaging difference to my attention in the store, and it really made me think, oh my goodness, he's paying attention to this, and I am not. I better get on the ball. But I do recycle in the house. I've had to because it was, you know, you have the trash can, you have the recycle bin that you have to put out every week. And I don't know. I got to tell you, I do still like the old incandescent bulbs. Something about having mercury in my light bulb just doesn't set right.
Okay, you know? Well, we've got an expert here. We have Kevin Roach. Deb just brought up a very specific thing. Some of the, in fact, light bulb legislation has changed recently, where I think the old light bulbs have been mandated out. The argument of CFL bulbs is a small amount of mercury that becomes an element in the process. How are those recycled, and how do you handle elements like mercury that you can't see in a light bulb that slips into the stream?
You know, my hope is that the CFL, or the complex fluorescent, is a bridge bulb. A bridge bulb to get us to the better bulb. There's lots of advantages with the CFL. There's no doubt about it, and it's good that we have them. from the solid waste aspect of it, people are throwing those bulbs away. We don't want them in the trash because they do contain, it's a very small amount of mercury, but there is mercury in them. And so we don't want them being processed through the waste-to-energy plant. We also don't want them in the recycling box as well, because if those bulbs break, and a lot of the material breaks when it gets mixed together in the recycling truck, that presents a problem to the people who are collecting it and the people who have to sort it as well. So the bulbs really need to go back to the transfer stations and the stores that accept them back for recycling. That's the proper...
But people won't... I mean, the reality, we just heard Deb admit that she's a scofflaw. We put her on the spot. So if the average person looks at, and a CFL bulb, and you multiply that times millions of bulbs, whether it's a microscopic dot of mercury or whatever... Mercury, again, I've got to go back to science 101, but is it a heavy mineral, but it doesn't dissipate. So mercury is bad for the environment because it's heavy, but it doesn't go away, right? It doesn't decompose. It doesn't.
Yeah, and I'm told that it volatilizes at low temperatures. So whether it's at the landfill or in a waste energy plant, that does get released. But if you compare it to the amount of electricity that is needed for an incandescent,
right,
it begins to balance itself out as the favorable bulb.
Well, see, I just never bought that story. I just never bought it.
You don't buy climate change.
No,
you don't buy gravity. Yeah. We've had this discussion, Deb.
If you can't throw it away and if it breaks, it's a major thing, then why? Why?
I think there's a lot of people that are in your place, and that's why I hope that it is the bridge bulb. And we're already seeing LEDs out there. They're too expensive right now, but they're coming.
They are. You're right.
Yeah, it's right in our parking lot, Deb. LED lights.
Yes, they are.
I mean, you've never been here working.
That's just state of the art.
I know, but you have never been working here late enough to see them.
No.
Because you bug out early.
I do.
But if you ever worked a full day and you saw the parking lot, you'd see LED bulbs.
I got to go home and recycle. I can't hang around
you're
here.
You're not recycling. By the way, we have Kevin Roche. He is the general manager of EcoMaine. Without naming the specific municipalities that are the owners and the folks that are using it, it is mostly concentrated in southern Maine. Is that safe to say in terms of the region that you cover?
Yeah. What's happened, Steve-O, is that with our great recycling habits and with the recession, we lost about 30% of our waste stream. So we could either just let the 30% of the waste stream, and that's, that goes for recyclable materials and waste materials.
You lost it because people were producing less, or what was the basis for losing that amount during the recession?
Well, think about it. If a business isn't doing so hot,
they're not
might close down for a few weeks. They're not producing as much. Guess what? They don't have as much waste. And the consumer, if they're tight, they're not going to buy as much. And if they're not going to buy as much, they don't have as much waste. So it's amazing to me. If you asked me pre-2007, are we going to lose 30% of our waste stream? Not a person in our industry would have said that was going to happen.
Wow.
And it just goes to show you that our industry is not recession-proof.
Wow. So that's the map.
So this is the map of our service area, and you can see where we started. That's these green communities, the 21 owner communities. But you can see we've gone south, actually, all the way now down to Hampton, New Hampshire. And we've gone north to Andover, Jay, Livermore Falls, Reedfield, Wayne, Monmouth.
Wow.
Why have we expanded in New Hampshire and gone north? Is because we've had to replace what we lost from the recession. And so we've maintained our capacity all along, but that's only because we've extended our service area.
Is there any interest or mandate or mission statement, because your name is EcoMaine, not EcoMaine in parts of New Hampshire, but is there any aspiration or hope to be able to provide these services throughout Maine, or is it not practical because of population or equipment or transportation? But why don't we do all of Maine? It's recycling's good, and why not expand even further?
Right. Well, I think transportation becomes an issue. Do we want a cart or haul waste from the very northern tip of Maine all the way down to, southern Maine? And so, efficiencies start to set in. What's unique about EcoMaine, though, is that we really don't rely on faraway places to manage our waste. Our waste-to-energy facility is located within the city of Portland limits. Our landfill is in South Portland in the town of Scarborough. Our recycling center is in Portland. And that's unique because if you go, you know, to a lot of the larger cities, you know, have filled up their landfills long ago, and they're really reliant on faraway places to manage their waste.
When we talk about landfills, and again, I like kind of jumping around here, you know, going back to Needham, Massachusetts, Deb's laughing. Right, Deb.
You're fine. I'm totally fine.
But talk a little bit about what are the environmental issues, the efficiency, and the thinking behind landfills. You know, we bury waste. Some materials decompose. Plastics and other materials have a half-life of like 4 billion years or something like that. But when our landfills, and you've got facilities that change waste into energy, but should landfills be a primary or a secondary option in terms of waste management? And what are the pros and cons where we take this waste, we dig these giant holes, and we bury things? And talk a little bit about landfill waste management, and is it the past, is it the future, or is it part of the mix?
Well, to me, it's really all about landfill diversion. We need to divert as much waste away from the landfill as possible, and that is why we have a hierarchy. The state of Maine has a hierarchy, and so does the EPA. It's very simple. Reduce, reuse, recycle first. Then compost and digestion, then waste to energy, and then the very bottom of the rung of the hierarchy is landfilling. If you can't use any other one of those strategies that's higher in the hierarchy, then you're forced to use a landfill. And that's, I think, our industry is faced with landfill diversion, and we need to get the public to understand that we don't want to be expanding landfills. It's going to be very hard to expand landfills in this day and age, and so we wanted to divert as much material away from the landfill as we possibly can.
And I agree intuitively that it's bad, but if you could explain maybe technically why it is so bad, you know, is it bad for groundwater? Is it bad for we're using a lot of land, or it takes so many years to be able to repurpose the land?
Key word here is storage. Landfill is a storage, a waste storage strategy. Landfilling is the cheapest option out there. So by default, things are going to go to the landfill. The problem with it is that you're deferring the true cost of dealing with the waste to future generations. I personally don't think my kids, my grandkids, should have to spend their money to deal with my waste. And so that's what clearly landfilling is you're deferring the true cost of dealing with the waste to future generations. Recently, we went out and did some excavation in our landfill. We had to do some remediation, and we dug up some waste from 25 years ago. Guess what we found? You could identify chicken breasts from 25 years ago, potato chips that looked edible from 25 years ago, and we could read the newspapers. And guess what the newspapers were reading? Ross Perot was making headlines running for president, along with his running mate, who had the gaffe in the
wow.
debate.
I bet you those potato chips were Pringles. I've always any potato chip in a can, to me, is suspect.
Yes,
it had to be
agree.
Full of chemicals, right? I think Lay's would be, because it feels like those were more tender. But
I find it hard to believe that chicken breast did not decompose in 25 years.
Well, today's landfill, they're engineered today, and what they do is they do a good job at preserving waste.
Compressing and taking the air out, and air, isn't air
well,
needed
so much
for decompression?
There's so much plastic in the waste now that it almost seals itself to some degree.
Oh, wow.
So it's amazing, and I'd love for the public to go out and do some of these projects with me, because they'd see for themselves that landfilling is indeed a storage strategy of waste. Now, I'm not saying that some of the waste is degrading, because you're getting methane gas being generated from a landfill. So that there is some that's being degraded, but not all of it.
Are we producing methane gas anywhere in Maine in terms of our landfill strategy, or in some states is it more of an active element?
Landfills are one of the largest generators, unfortunately, of methane gas. Versus waste energy, we have carbon dioxide, but we don't have methane gas.
Can the methane gas be used as an energy source, or is it really just more pollution?
No, and landfills are doing a good job. We still need landfills. As a solid waste professional, I recognize we still need landfills. And if you're going to have a landfill, then yes, you want to pull off the gas and generate electricity from that. The problem is that you're going to, if you have a 250-acre landfill, pretty hard to capture all of those emissions from that large space. And the other thing is not everything is going to generate gas. Let's say a bottle of detergent, that's not going to give you any gas.
Wow. We have Kevin Roche. He is the general manager of EcoMaine. EcoMaine is... have to be by far the largest waste management entity here in Maine, right? In terms of public municipalities participating.
That's correct.
Let's talk a little bit about policy, and obviously your role as general manager is in day-to-day running the operation, but so much that. Impacts and controls our lives both as consumers, as municipal leaders, and within state and federal guidelines is driven by federal and state policy. You know, we have the EPA, we have the DEP, and depending on if it involves water, sometimes the Army Corps of Engineers. So there's all kinds of federal agencies and there's all kinds of state oversight. How have policy changes since you've started in this business impacted both the consumer side of it and the waste management treatment, what can be done? How have you seen that shift, which I think has to be a huge catalyst to changing behavior, and what would you like to see done even more, and where could we really improve in policy that'll be better for people and better for the environment?
Right. Policy really has come a long way over the years that I've been in the industry for 25 years. And, we're cleaning up the waste industry.
I mean, back from the Aaron Brockovich days where, car companies would be dumping, paint residual and all kinds of poisons and water streams and stuff. I mean, we've made a lot of Clean Water Acts. There's been a lot of stuff. So people are working on it, right?
People are definitely working on it, and investments are being made. Our pollution control system has come a long way since we started, and those investments were made by our owner communities so that we could be a cleaner neighbor. Is it a perfect process? No. But again, by comparison, I say that it's better than the waste storage strategy. Right. I go back to that. So, yeah, we definitely have come a long way, but we have a long way to go. One of my worries now is we've come a long way about getting waste out of a landfill, this key issue of landfill diversion. And one of the things is, towns are strapped for cash, they're strapped for money, they're looking for cheaper ways of doing things. My worry is the landfill might come back to be an attractive option for a community because it's going to be cheaper for them. And I would hate to see us go back to using landfills the way we used to use them before. And so we need good policy.
I fell in once, okay? I must have suppressed this memory because I didn't bring it. This is back in Needham, Mass.
You fell in.
Well, I think my brother pushed me. To tell you the truth, the sport, and again, this goes back into the 60s. I mean, you weren't even born yet, Deb. But there were eight tracks. There were, it was the tie-dye period.
Right.
Oh, the giddy
times.
But you'd stand on the edge of the dump and then throw bottles and trash, and the seagulls would come down and grab things out. And I think my brother shoved me into the landfill.
Oh, boy.
That explains some things.
That was a harrowing experience, I'm sure.
I know, but the whole message that Kevin here is talking about is, while landfills may be necessary for some materials, we have to work to minimize those because long term, we're just storing stuff in the earth.
Yeah, but even in my young days when we went to the dump, because I remember this as well, we had people there at the dump recycling. They would take things that people would throw away and they would either bring it home or they would sell it right there at the dump.
Yeah, the bringing home thing always kind of threw me off a little bit. Yeah.
But what percentage of our trash now actually ends up in a dump after it goes through all of those, you know, the recycling, et cetera? How much is actually left to go in the dump compared to what we used to put in?
Well, our recycling rate in the state of Maine is between 30 and 40%. On average, it's about 34, 35%. So that's a key number, and that's a number that we want to increase. And there's ways to, you know, the state's goal for years has been 50%, and there's ways we can get to 50%, but we need, you know, this is where we need some government intervention. This is where government intervention is both appropriate and necessary, because we need some incentives to make that happen.
Well, what do
some
you
incentives
need?
To divert material from the landfill. We need incentives to limit the amount of material that's going into landfill. So there should be some restrictions on what we place in the landfill. There should be, you know, the landfill in my mind should be the most expensive option. It's the least desirable option for managing waste. I think everybody in the industry agrees with that. And so we need ways to incentivize us not to place it in the landfill. And if it's the cheapest option, guess where stuff is going to keep going? To the landfill. And it is the cheapest option. You know, if my board came to me today and they said, look, Kevin, we want to reduce rates. How do we do it? First thing I'd say is, you really want to reduce rates? Close the waste energy plant.
Wow.
Now, that's not going to be good for our kids, because we're going to fill up our landfill. In our landfill, we're pretty lucky to have a landfill that's still located within two miles of downtown Portland.
Wow. Where is, I should know this, but where is the landfill?
It's right in the corner, the western corner of South Portland and Scarborough. It's about lies half, so it'd be west of the Jetport.
And what percent of the landfill is occupied, and where do you project that filling up, and where's the next big landfill?
Well, you know, so long as we continue to operate our waste energy plant, where we get a 90% reduction in the volume of the waste by processing it through the waste energy plant and recovering electricity,
right.
If we continue to get that 90% volume reduction, our landfill will be good through 2040. It'll fill up 10 times faster if we don't.
I am surprised we still only have a 30% recycle rate.
Yeah, are there other states? I mean, obviously, as the general manager of Eco Maine, we have Kevin Roche here. You work with, I'm sure, national organizations, and there's an association. Once a year, you guys all meet at some big waste plant and, you know, look at the new technology. Are there some states much more advanced in terms of their recycling rates? And if so, What are the key factors? And if Maine is between 30 and 40%, and we aspire to be at 50%, what are some of the key elements that would help us get there? And what are other states doing that may be more effective?
You know, what would get us, what's left in the waste? If you look at the waste that's left over after recycling, we apply the 40-20-40 rule. 40% of it is organic waste that could be either composted or digested. 20% of the leftover waste stream is recyclable, and 40% is what we would actually call trash that probably is going to have to go to a waste energy plant or a landfill. So 60% of what we're taking either to landfills or waste energy plants right now could be recovered either through organics recycling or just better recycling programs. So there is huge opportunities out there. And again, I go back to, we need to disincentivize landfills.
Got it. Let me ask you a self-serving question here specific to Yarmouth, where at the Woods household, I forget who the contract is, I should know, but Pine Tree, Yarmouth has not. We have a transfer station, which is, some people consider the community gathering place. Every Saturday, everyone goes to the transfer station. There's a bit of a social element where,
hey,
true. How you doing? Great to see you.
Do you go?
Once in a while, but we use this service, the Pine Tree truck guy, and it's like this giant truck, right? And it used to be, you mentioned the process where there'd be like seven guys doing different things. It's this one guy in a truck, and it's all computerized, and the bins are coded with some sort of computer code, and we have a green for recycling, and we have a brown bin that is trash, and this giant claw comes out. And right when I'm at the deepest point of my sleep, at about 6:40 on Monday mornings. I can count on this giant truck coming up, and the claw grabs the green and then throws it into the recycling section of the giant trash truck, and then the claw automatically comes out, grabs the brown one, dumps it into another bin. And then what appears to be, and also a very critical part of the process, is the guy operating the jar or the claw, he then throws the things down on the curb so they fall over and they create a mess. Apparently, the technology is great right up to that point. And at that point, he's hustling to get to the next place and grab all that. I have heard different reports, different points of view, that if everyone went on that system and there was greater efficiency in terms of these trucks doing this, if you had one truck collecting all of the trash for 200 homes versus 200 cars, and if you really looked at it holistically, so if 200 people drive to the transfer station, they're using petroleum, they're using rubber on the roads, they're breaking down the asphalt, there's all kinds of time value. People get hungry from doing that, so they have to come back and consume more food, and Dunkin' Donut boxes have to go. So is there any clear view on, is it better for individuals to be managing their own waste by going to the dump or the transfer station, or are there systems either now or in the future that make it more efficient and a better controlled system, like the truck with the big claw?
Yes, but before I say that, did you just say you were criticizing her for leaving work early and you're still asleep at 6:40?
Thank you for noticing that.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, I am a slacker. Thank you for pointing that out, Kevin. At 6:40, I am just, well, yeah. But okay. But I work till midnight, Kevin. What you don't understand is I work two shifts.
Yeah, and that's, I leave just, at one. He can.
Yeah, of course. So 6:40, the giant thing, the beeping thing in the neighborhood, the claw that picks it up, which is unbelievable, and then throws it down and it's like they're like bowling pins down my street. And then, you know, somebody calls and then a supervisor comes out and all that. But that's relatively new technology. It used to be, you know, a guy named Freddie who hung on the back, right? And it actually looked like a cool job. I mean, you're handling waste, so you're getting a little bit dirty. But hanging onto the back of a trash truck as you zip down the road, you know, I'm sure it was hard to get insurance for those guys, because I think sometimes kind of a high risk job. But now it's all computerized.
Yeah.
So is that helping or hurting in our quest to be more ecologically sensitive to the environment and waste management?
I think that any town that has density, population density, has got to consider curbside collection. Because I know in my town, you know, everybody drives their pickup truck. If you're going to go to the dump, you got to have a pickup truck. So that means you got to keep your pickup truck, because you don't want to put that stuff in your car.
See, that's an advancement. I bring you back to my childhood traumas. We were in a Country Squire Ford wagon, where the seats in the back folded up and the trash were on our laps. And just the memories, the horror. Things were dripping. We shouldn't even go there.
You poor boy.
I know. But now people have pickup trucks, so you can kind of throw it in back, and, you know, you're not subjecting to, you know, 4 or 5 year old kids that are going to live with trauma for 50 years.
So we all pull up on Saturday morning with our pickup trucks idling at the transfer station, yep, waiting in line to dump our trash.
Right.
I think if you do the economics, if the population density is there, there's a better way. And I think that's why we have curbside collection. I mean, the city of Portland, can you imagine in a city that size, if everybody was carting their trash to the transfer station? You know, at some point it doesn't make sense. So I think an individual town, you know, if you only have 100 residents, obviously you know, it probably doesn't make sense. But I think the individual town has to look at the full picture of what it's costing each resident to take their pickup truck or whatever car they're using and cart their recyclables and their waste into the transfer station. But a lot of times what happens is when they do the cost analysis on these programs, they don't take that cost for you, Steve-O, to bring your waste from your home to the transfer station because they feel that that's not a cost that's part of the should be part of the formulation or the calculation, but it should be.
Wow, we've got Kevin Roche here who's dispensing both wisdom in terms of recycling, but a fair amount of guilt, mostly directed at Deb. I'm kidding, of course.
Bringing up a lot of childhood memories for you.
Yeah, this is therapeutic, Kevin. Mm. Thank you for bringing me back to the Needham Dump. We have Kevin Roche, the general manager of EcoMaine. Let me shift it a little bit. You know, I'm guessing you've probably been to New York City before, right, Kevin?
Certainly, yeah.
Okay. Deb?
Oh, yes.
Big Apple?
Yep.
It amazes me, right? So here we have New York City, which is... I don't know if L.A. or New York are considered by population the largest cities, but it's one of the top two or three cities. It is the financial capital of not only the United States, but with Wall Street, probably the world. And so we have all these advancements and sophistications involving New York City. And, you know, we've got Frank Sinatra singing New York, New York, and all this other stuff. But the way they handle waste pickup is... You can go down this beautiful street. You can go to a Broadway show, and you can go have some, you know, go to Sardi's or go to a famous Italian restaurant and have some delicious tiramisu, which I love, by the way.
Yes.
And you're walking among trash. The state of the art in New York is the restaurants and all the buildings pile their trash. In every 2 years and 4 months when there's a trash strike, which feels like it happens on a regular basis, the trash piles up into, like, giant mountains. Opposite of that is beautiful Barcelona, Spain. Deb, have you been?
I have been there.
Really?
Yes, really.
How about you, Kev?
I have not.
Okay, you've got to go to Barcelona, Spain, just for the trash, okay? I was in Barcelona last year, and you drive down the streets of Barcelona, and on almost every corner, it's either three or four of these high-tech looking kind of dome units, and there's a red, a white, and a blue, and there may be a green, and they're made out of like fiberglass, and they're like high-tech looking. And the way the system works in Barcelona, and the city is spotless, is if you live on that block or you have a business on that block and you have something plastic, it goes into whatever it is, the yellow thing. If you have newspaper or paper, it goes into the other thing. If you're recycling, it goes into... And every day, these trucks go along, and a blue truck, you know, automatically with the big claw thing again, picks up the blue thing and efficiently does that. And it is such... I don't know if you can use the word elegant to describe trash pickup, but it is such a smart system. And converse, you know, then you look at New York, and it's a bunch of guys yelling at each other, boop, boop, hey, bud, get out of the way, boop. And we've got these bags of trash, and it's seeping into the sidewalk, and you're getting it on your toes. And here you have Barcelona, where there are these giant canisters that are all modern, they're clean, and the policy is, and it's controlled, if you throw some green kind of refuse in a blue thing, I'm sure they take you away and hit you or something. So people comply, but they have a system that's smart. They invest in a system. In New York, how can they not figure out trash? And I know that we're not in New York, but when you trickle down that type of thinking, why don't we take trash more seriously?
Well, you hit, the word is compliance.
Right.
Okay. In New York, are you going to get compliance? You know, if you put that system in New York, are people going to comply? And I think that's the big question with a lot of these programs is what works in Portland may not work in New York.
Yeah, the
paper bag. Not paper bag, but pay per throw, I should call it.
Oh, right.
You need compliance for that program to work. It works in Portland. It works in Falmouth. It works in a lot of our communities because people are willing to go out and buy the bag and put their trash in the bag. A lot of big cities, pay per throw does not work because they can't get compliance.
Again, we're not here to fix New York, but I think it's fascinating. Why do you think, since you are an expert and a guru in waste and trash management, how can Barcelona, which is a major city, is it a cultural thing? Is it, and are the people in New York just not trying hard enough? And somehow they accept, as part of the landscape, we will have to walk through trash every time we walk down the street, because we as a society, and as that applies to local governments, if we don't prioritize these things, and then we wonder, how do we get to this place where we have trash, where we have health issues, education issues, all this other stuff, and then we wonder why? To me, it starts with the trash. If we can't figure out something as basic as walking through junk and food and organic material is bad, and then you try to add complex systems or organizational societal systems, then woe is the republic. So
it's hard, like you said, it's prioritize. You've got to prioritize this stuff as a society, right?
Well, yeah. And then you have, you know, people like Deb who deny climate change, and that confuses the whole thing. And then all of a sudden, I've been talking to her about isotopes for years. And again, I flunk science, but I know a little bit about, you know, ocean acidity and isotopes and polar cap stuff. In the next couple of minutes that we have before we finish up, and this has really been interesting, by the way, we have Kevin Roche here. He is the general manager of EcoMaine. Anyone interested in what they do from a technical or from a policy standpoint, their website is ecomaine.org. Very comprehensive website, lots of information there. But if you could say we should do something, if you know, an actionable thing, that if the Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O show and the immense power in our 42-watt antenna and our millions of listeners, if we could mobilize in some way to help with this issue, what are actionable steps that we could do to try to, you know, change the course a little bit?
Right. A couple of things. Remember Iron Eyes, Cody?
Sure.
Okay, remember the commercial?
Yep.
Going down the road, somebody throws out the McDonald's bag or whatever it is, and you see a tear coming down his cheek. I mean, I remember that as a small kid, and I still remember it today, and it sinks in with me. I mean, littering is an issue. And so you go to, you know, it goes to enforcement or compliance. Which one do you use? Right. Reinforcement. And so I think in some of these larger cities, you mentioned New York, it's hard to enforce. And it's hard to just use the carrot, and that's all. And so it is you're prioritizing. Are you going to apply the hammer with people who don't comply? So I think sometimes it's a challenge, and I think the larger cities, it's even more of a challenge. But I think that it's all about education. And, you know, we have a budget for education, and we're very fortunate to have a budget for education, because our communities, in our mission statement, as I read earlier in the show, our mission statement says that raising a public awareness about effective solid waste management is a priority for us. And so we need to educate. And so we need to educate our kids, and we need to educate our grown-ups as well. And so that to me is a key in order to continue to progress to more effective solid waste management strategies.
Hey, we could have covered so much. Can I ask you one final favor, Kevin?
Sure.
I would love to go on a tour of your facility at some point, because not only is Yarmouth one of the owner communities, and so from a local government standpoint, I'm really fascinated. But also, I'm a big fan of process. I'm a big fan of the environment and the work that you guys do there are really, really incredible. So at some point, A, I would like to have you come back to talk about this some more. But B, I would like to set up a time and really see the facility and understand it a little bit deeper.
Does it have to be at 6 o'clock in the afternoon?
No. I will get up early. I will get up before the beep, beep, beep of the curbside collect. Anytime you can get me in there, I'll wear a hard hat. If there has to be some special, you know, boot requirement, I can do that.
Only if you bring Deb along.
Okay.
It's a deal.
Maybe if she sees it up close, she'll be more sensitive to this kind of stuff.
Maybe.
Sometimes Deb's like that. She can read it, but unless she's really going through the experience...
Love it.
Anyhow, we've run out of time. Kevin, thank you so much for being here.
Enjoyed it.
Kevin Roche, he's the general manager of EcoMaine. Go to their website, ecomaine.org. A lot of interesting experience. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. Thank you.